Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds, the associate producer of the Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, March 5th, Joe was out and Sarah LaDuke hosted. She was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, and former White House advance lead and former chief of staff for Michelle Hinchey, Anna Markowitz.
Last night, President Trump delivered the longest address to Congress in modern presidential history. He signaled a reset with Ukraine, reiterated his belief in tariffs, and stressed his support for Elon Musk's effort to overhaul the government. Democrats lodged protests throughout the evening, with one representative getting kicked out and others holding signs in silent opposition and some walking out throughout the speech. But Mr. Trump argued it was the Democrats who left him a country besieged by crisis and that his administration was working to clean them up. Mr. Trump widened his trade wars on Tuesday when he instituted sweeping tariffs on imports from Canada, Mexico, and China. Despite the markets plunging in response to his actions last night, President Trump claimed he would not budge, dismissing the reaction as a little disturbance. He said more tariffs would go into effect on April 2nd. Presidents often use addresses to joint sessions of Congress to lay out their agenda for the year, but Mr. Trump did not. He did not unveil new policies and devoted little time to the wars in Ukraine and Gaza, both of which he had vowed to end. He also did not address another time-sensitive issue, how to prevent the government from shutting down next week. Even with Republicans controlling the House and the Senate, there are still disagreements about the best ways to proceed on the funding battle. Also in the speech, the president reiterated that he wanted Congress to allocate more money for immigration enforcement while cutting taxes. But how lawmakers will achieve that remains unclear. He's always in need of an opponent. And for now, it appears that former President Joe Biden is still in his crosshairs. Even after winning the election in November, defeating Kamala Harris, Mr. Trump mentioned his predecessor's administration more than a dozen times and called President Biden the worst president in American history. He blamed President Biden for a litany of problems, including the high cost of eggs, crime and drugs, flooding across the border, and accused him of being weak in China. At times, Mr. Trump appeared to be giving one of his stump speeches from the campaign trail as he rallied against Mr. Biden's immigration policies, support of transgender rights and wokeness. He told a lot of lies. He attacked a lot of people. And we are going to talk about it this morning. Teresa, would you like to begin? Or Anna?
Anna, you want to start?
Go ahead, Anna.
Sure. Where do we start? There's so much to talk about.
The summary I just read was none of it. So go ahead. I mean, really, there was so much.
There was so much. And I mean, it really was about the culture war and about highlighting the things that he considers wins and kind of humiliating the prior administration. And, some of the lies, I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about all of them or many of them. I mean, egg prices, like, does not mention bird flu and the fact that that is a main reason and that egg prices have continued to go up under his presidency. Social Security, lots of laugh lines about people older than America getting benefits. But, you know, he didn't mention that the Social Security office automatically stops payments when someone's 115. A lot of those were errors because of how they code ages in their system.
Yeah, a number of times people to judge posted about that. Bernie Sanders addressed it.
Right. I mean, and so, you know, he's just saying things that are blatantly debunked to make it look like the government is more inefficient than it is. And to just kind of give DOGE a wider net to cut things. And so I think it was a big spectacle. It was a reality TV show for him. And, you know, he brought out people who suffered the worst atrocities from immigrants that possibly could have happened. I mean, if you brought out the two worst crimes committed by Americans, they would have been equally shocking. So I just think it was quite a spectacle. But I'm looking forward to hearing what other people think as well.
I don't think you're going to get much pushback on that estimation, but we will speak about it in more detail. Bob?
So last night, and if any of the listeners didn't stay up and watch last night's event, don't. It was deflection. I mean, it was incredible to hear the narcissist in chief talking about it, but it was also disturbing to watch the keister kissing. And if you do get a chance to watch part of it, the constant popping up and clapping wildly, particularly watching Vance and Johnson, was just stomach-turning. But it was also disconcerting to me to watch the pouting on behalf of the Democrats. And I think one of the issues that we need to talk about is, what is the vision for either one of these parties? There was no future that was laid out last night by either the president or frankly, I think from the Democratic side. And this is a conversation that we have to have. Trump tripled down on the boogeyman. He gave his base a lot of red meat. He clearly solidified the divide between the Democrats and Republicans, and made it very clear what his thinking is of anybody who supports the Democratic position. His boogeymen are immigrants, certainly trans students, especially athletes, which I will note the NCAA says there's approximately 10 in the country. So when we're talking about this flood, we're talking about 10 out of a population of, what, 370 million or whatever the number is. Federal workers, who I will note that the majority are veterans. Certainly Joe Biden is still occupying space in his head, considerable space in his head. Although it was interesting to watch the mental gymnastics that went on between when it's something bad, it was Biden's fault, and when it's something that they were that he was able to do, it's his win, and this whole notion about reclaiming power. With this idea that he at one point he actually had the gall to say about reclaiming power from his unaccountable bureaucracy, and then goes on to praise Elon Musk, who is running an illegal department and is part of is unaccountable to anybody. You're right. The State of the Union always is theater in politics. Usually, though, it's an effort to sort of say what the future is. As I'm thinking, as I'm watching the two mental midgets behind Trump jump up and down every time he says something, all I can think of is that behind that American flag, there is this steaming dumpster fire going on of tariffs, of a trade war. I don't know if anybody noticed that the public declaration that came out of the Chinese embassy about if the United States wants war, whether it's economic, social, or political, we're prepared. We really cranked it. We really cranked it up to 10.
We didn't. Trump did.
But here's the problem. Okay,
he's the
whether
president
we like
of the
it or
United
not,
States.
It's the policy of the United States right now. I have a lot more comments, but let me turn it over to Teresa and give her a chance, and then we can go around again.
And I apologize for interrupting.
No,
the "we" thing really bothers me, because I hear the Democrats say "we," I hear the House and Senate Republicans say "we," and we have to keep remembering who we are in this case. It's just a little picadillo of mine. So for me, it really began with just thinking about the room in which they were in, and Trump standing there in that building, in that House chamber. And as I wrote to people last night, a number of friends and folks here, I just could not stop thinking about the fact that Trump and his minions in that room, the January 6th, that's the same room that the January 6th insurrectionists, they breached that chamber in a very violent way. And they attacked our democracy. And the man there at the podium, Donald Trump, by all accounts, he fomented that. And I kept thinking about all of the law enforcement people who fought to preserve our capital and our democracy, and 140 who were seriously, seriously injured. And they fought to protect the lives of many of the elected officials in that room and their staffs. And those same people were clapping for the person who fomented that. And not only did he foment that, when our justice system went to work, and those folks, many of them were prosecuted, and several of them served jail sentences. This person standing there then pardoned them. Okay, not okay. But then, and again on Friday, he called them hostages. He pardoned them, but then he had fired people in the Justice Department who did their jobs. And most recently, he demoted a number of people in the FBI and the Justice Department who did their jobs, protecting our democracy. And, you know, the people who brought those insurrectionists to justice have been done a terrible injustice. And he is who he is. But I cannot get over those people sitting there whose lives those police officers protected. They clap for this person. And even when he said that he's on the side of law enforcement, because not only did he not stand up for the law enforcement people who stood up to protect their lives, they are now moving legislation through the process that will cut funding for police officers. And that's one of the things he lied about in a big way last night that I thought was incredibly just so unacceptable. I noted, too, the unaccountable bureaucracy. His disdain for the federal workforce was palpable and totally unacceptable. To use them as a foil, the people who keep us safe every day, was just, you know, it's he keeps doing it. It's totally inappropriate. And I want to hear from federal workers, if any of them are listening, or people who are family members of federal workers, because there were a number of stories last night where people were telling about what their circumstances of being fired were. I also think that he, you know, it was really big picture. It was a disinformation campaign of amazing proportions. He said what he said over and over again on immigration. Well, let's start with him beginning by saying that President Biden said he needed a bill to deal with immigration, and what we needed was a new president. And everybody loved that line. But then what did he do? He went on to say, I need a bill to deal with immigration. That was his whole thing after denigrating Biden for saying, I need a bill, I need legislation, because I need funding. His whole, everything that followed was, I need a bill.
The same bill, perhaps, that he encouraged the Republicans to block to while Biden was president?
Except for far more money. And he repeated the lie that this bothers me with the media. They let him say this over and over again. He keeps talking about how these countries have emptied their jails and their prisons and their mental facilities and sent them all to our country. And over again, the administration has been asked to give any proof for that, and they have never been able to. Yeah. But you know who did empty their jails of the January 6th insurrectionists? President Trump did, right? But he could not, you know, it's insidious. And then one other thing that I want to talk about is that adorable little boy with brain cancer. And that beautiful story about wanting to be a police officer and him being, I can't even talk about this without crying, because that was a beautiful story. And that was a beautiful young child. And I can't, you know, the smile on his face was so wonderful. But what did this president do in the first 30 days? He cut funding for cancer research, and particularly he cut funding for cancer research for children. And proof of that was a senator from Illinois. His guest was a researcher, a renowned children's brain cancer researcher, who has had to stop her research because her funding has been frozen for no reason. How insidious is that? How can you use a child like that? And I'm sure the parents didn't know, and I am so happy that that child had that experience. But the facts behind that, one of my jobs when I worked in the Senate and the House was to develop these personal stories, you know, to try to convey through these personal stories. And, you know, sometimes you wouldn't have all the background, and it might be a good story, but it wasn't the right story, but you'd worked hard to get it. But that's so obviously, when you cut research for brain cancer for children, and then you have a personal story, what kind of human being does that?
And beyond that, just also the fact that he's cutting regulations on dangerous chemicals in our air and water at the same time that he's saying, oh, this kid probably has cancer because of a toxic substance that he was exposed to. And what are you, in addition to just cutting cancer research, also cutting regulations that would prevent other cancers like that from happening to other small children?
We are, as we knew we would, getting quite a lot of email this morning. So let me read one to start another arm of this conversation. John writes in and says, throw out a Democrat disrespecting the Republican president during a speech. But Republicans screaming liar at Obama or interrupting Biden's State of the Union, that's A-okay. It's okay if you're a Republican. It's a crime if you're a Democrat. And that is from John. Let us talk about the Democratic response last night. People were dressed in pink to protest the president's treatment of women and women's rights in America. There were kind of auction paddles saying Musk lies, protect Medicaid, and other things like that. Or Musk steals. It said Musk steals. They also did say lies and liar. Some people walked out during the speech as it progressed. What do we want to say in this room about the Democratic response? Also, we should point out Trump pointing out that they wouldn't stand or clap in a very snide and smug and irritating to me way.
Yeah, and he went back and he poked through his entire speech. I thought actually the best response was Elizabeth Warren's response when she didn't take the bait. However, I think the Democrats looked generally unlikable. There were stories that, regardless of your party, you should have appreciated. And the child that Teresa was talking about, that situation, I think, warranted a warmer response from the Democrats. I think their efforts to be impassive actually backfired on them. I think they looked generally unlikable. Now, I don't know what the solution is. I will note the hypocrisy of what was done last night versus what was done when Biden was up there. But again, there's all of this faux outrage no matter what happens at these events, somebody's going to be outraged.
I don't know what their other option was. I mean, they're
neither
not going to,
it would seem,
stand and clap for Trump, who is you know, dismantling all that Biden passed in his 4 years. And they don't have a chance to, like, stand up and, like, have a conversation with Trump. That's not the moment. I think that what they need to do is come out from the speech with a plan and with talking points. And I think that they did a really good job picking the U.S. Senator from Michigan,
Slotkin,
who was very eloquent and actually, I think, did a really good job responding to Trump's speech last night, saying this is not the time to not be engaged. This is the time to pick one issue that you're passionate about and fight for, really talking about how the American people are going to bear the cost of all of these plans, such as tariffs, such as tax cuts, that this is really coming for the middle class, and kind of debunking some of Trump's talking points. So I think that was a really good pick from the Democrats to respond.
That was Anna Markowitz on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, March 5th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, March 6th, Joe was out and Sarah LaDuke hosted. She was joined by Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel, former Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain, and investment banker on Wall Street, Mark Whitman.
Less than 48 hours after slapping tariffs on all goods from Canada and Mexico, President Donald Trump agreed to a one-month reprieve for automobile imports that qualify for duty-free treatment under the North American Trade Agreement negotiated during his first term. The president's decision followed a phone conversation with executives from the big three automakers, General Motors, Ford, and Stellantis, who sought relief from the new import taxes. Each of the automakers over the past several decades have developed complex supply chains that cross North American borders multiple times before delivering a finished product, which is something we've been mentioning frequently as we've discussed these tariffs on the show the last week or two. Along with disrupting those supply chains, Trump's tariffs would have increased the cost of a typical new car by more than $10,000, the industry groups said. Asked if Trump expected automakers to be able to relocate production in the next month, Caroline Leavitt, the White House press secretary, said yes. Automakers could begin planning potential production moves and communicating those changes to their suppliers within that 30-day window, assuming that there is idle capacity at an existing plant in the United States. Some work could shift from a Canadian or Mexican plant within the next several months. Those possible successes in moving manufacturing to U.S. put into words by Bill Hurls, a retired auto industry supply chain executive with 38 years experience. We should note he did have, you know, a lot of qualifications in the success of that possibility, assuming there's an idle plant, et cetera. But any short-term production could be limited by union contracts. A manufacturer's commitments to local governments may have offered tax breaks and suppliers' capacity. So, a rather tumultuous time in the auto industry and every industry. Who would like to begin talking about this one? Mark.
Yeah, hi. This is Mark Whitman.
Thank you for being here. I guess I did just introduce you guys and not say hello. Hello.
Hello.
Howdy.
So, I've been thinking a lot about Trump's tariffs and how much destruction they will rain down on our economic system and in our political standing in the world. And I want to start with basic principles. I think some of the initial warnings about how damaging tariffs are were overdone by people in the news media who heard economists say something and then took it to an extreme. If you think about a system in which countries trade effectively amongst one another and the system benefits all, there are basically two extremes that explain how it can work. One extreme is if everyone in the trading system has about equal power and they work things out cooperatively amongst themselves. The other extreme is if there's a dominant player who can basically impose restrictions on everybody else, but does so in a way that maximizes free trade and therefore maximizes the benefit to all the participants. The other option for that dominant player, and frankly in simplified terms in the global markets, the United States is the dominant player, is for that dominant player to use its power and to dial back on the free trade dial and increase their own share of the aggregate pie. And frankly, that's what Trump is after. If he gets his way, and if he did it in a very logical, methodical, careful way, some of what the economists have said would happen wouldn't be so bad. There likely will be an increase in costs, i.e. inflation, but that's a one-time increase, at least of the way we measure inflation in this country. We probably would bring some jobs back to the United States, and we probably would lose a little bit of our political clout in the world. But we've already, so now we go to the real world case. The United States and other countries don't practice pure free trade. There are plenty of tariffs. And as a matter of fact, the rest of the world tends to use tariffs more than we do. So we have been the good guy with the we've had the good operator with the power to put down the hammer to our own benefit. We've never used it. Is it a surprise that Donald Trump picks up that, you know, looks at that shiny potential hammer and says, I'd like to use this, right, at the expense of geopolitical cooperation in order to maximize the economic well-being of my populace. But the other problem with Donald Trump is anytime he picks up a hammer, he wields it like a toddler. And this particular case of having now to backtrack on the auto tariffs is a perfect example. It would take somewhere between 18 months to 2 years at a minimum. If the United States just decided, look, for national security reasons, we want to produce our own cars full stop, or at least as much of it as is humanly possible, it would take a tremendous amount of time and care to get to that state of economic affairs. And so our favorite toddler with this hammer is bringing damage onto the economy, not only because he's sub-optimizing the theory of optimal trade between countries, but probably even more so in real costs because of the capricious and emotional way in which he's yielding this power. And I think it's important when you sort through what's happening and what you read about it to be a little skeptical of some sort of the absolute economic declarations of how bad tariffs are, but to be very acutely aware of the cost of these frictions that Donald Trump and his administration are bringing on us in real economic terms.
Mike?
Yeah, it's hard to follow something like that, but I'll try.
Thank you.
I mean, what is the goal here? I mean, is the goal really to bring all components of manufacturing automobiles back within the borders of the U.S.? Because I think that if that were to happen, the European car makers, the Chinese car makers, the Japanese, Korean car makers would all eat our lunch. They would be able to deliver cars during that transition at a more competitive price, and it would not help the big three, so to speak, whatever that means anymore, you know. But it wouldn't help the big three automakers in the end. And the deal, I mean, the USMCA, the trade deal with Mexico and Canada that Trump himself brokered, would be broken by this. It's going to, I don't know, it looks like chaos. To me, this 30-day reprieve is probably going to be followed by some announcements by the big three that they're beginning that transition you referenced, Mark. You know, we're identifying, we've opened negotiations with the unions, we're identifying space within our factory surplus factory areas, and we're going to start that transition. And whether it even really ever happens is less important than Trump saying, okay, then we're going to hold back and we're not going to tax you during that transition, and then it'll just all go away, and there'll be other carve-outs, I'm sure, for other industries along the way too. And Trump will have the appearance of having imposed these tariffs that are punitive in so many ways, and yet little by little they'll have less impact. We'll make a deal with, Justin Trudeau, and we'll make a deal with Mexico, and it won't have as much impact as maybe the economists worry about, but it'll allow Trump to save face. This is what I think is going to happen.
Nick?
Hi, this is Nick.
Hi, Nick.
I'm supposed to say, by the way, that my opinions are my own.
Okay.
Yes.
They don't represent the position of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York.
Surprisingly, Lazny does not have a position on tariffs. Okay. So, if you were to believe that the purpose of the tariffs is to bring manufacturing jobs back to the U.S., there is some evidence that some of that is happening a little bit, or might be able to sort of reengage in some of those. I think they're being described as just idle manufacturing facilities. But hiring and training and upstarting whole portions of a manufacturing supply line is expensive and it's time consuming and it would take a while. And in the meantime, the price of those vehicles will go up, and there is no universe where prices go that far back down. So we will just forever be paying substantially more for vehicles, even though and even if they're made in the U.S. There are some really interesting questions around labor shortages in the U.S., union protections, and what that looks like in this environment, and where these locations would be. We know it's difficult to open new manufacturing plants in some areas and regions where there are human beings who could work in them. I think those things are really complicated. And as Mark said, you have this hammer, and a hammer doesn't solve those really complicated nuances in the supply chain development. The other thing that's sort of like woven in here is, and that I'm just kind of curious about in a philosophical way, is we know that certain industries are just in favor with this administration. And we do know that certain very wealthy donors are able to pay for time at dinners with the president. We used to call them bribes. we know that happens. And it's curious, where are the manufacturing billionaires? Like, what are they doing behind the scenes? And what do those conversations look like? Because they are taking a hit by having to like come back to the U.S. and pay U.S. wages, right? Like, there is actually a cost to manufacturing, to increasing those wages and being here in the U.S. So I'm just kind of watching as these pieces kind of land in that big hammer.
Jeremy writes in and adds to the conversation that tariffs will not create more U.S. manufacturing jobs. It will only speed up the inevitable transition to automation. Also something to discuss. But doesn't it seem like Nick was saying before the break, all of these things, you can't just turn on a light switch and a factory is working, even if it did work before. There's, you know, repairs, staffing, et cetera. And then the, you know, transition to automation would, of course, be very technical and time consuming, one would think. Discuss, panel.
Well, I mean, you also are have to realize why those factories closed and why these jobs moved overseas. And there's so many dynamics to that. And to, you just can't pick it up and bring it back and expect it not to be an enormous cost. And as you said, Sarah, I mean, you don't just go in and start. If you were going to build a factory to make widgets, you wouldn't make them the way you would have made them in the 1990s. You would make them in a much different way. Most of it would be automated, and it would use contemporary technology. And that doesn't roll out without a lot of bumps, it's a tough transition. And then, and what will it achieve? It won't make, if the cars really do cost, do you think that's a fair and accurate estimate, $10,000 more? Yeah, I mean,
that should anger some bases.
Yeah,
citizens, I mean,
if an American made car is just out of the gate going to cost $10,000 more, then that is not going to make American cars more competitive. They'll probably only be sold in the U.S. And then, you know, you have your Korean and your Japanese companies that are making cars in the U.S., and they won't be affected by this. They can go and make them the way that they currently make them. And it's not a very happy prospect for the auto industry.
Mark?
Jeremy gets a gold star for the day.
The letter writer.
Yep. He's
Jeremy, we're going to catch up to you.
Well, I think to say that onshoring production in the United States may not lead to as many job gains as you would first suspect is correct for a couple of reasons. Number one, we're a higher rate labor environment, and as a result, manufacturers trade off automation for labor. And if you want to see a great example of that, there was a cartoon I saw years ago when McDonald's, well, I shouldn't have mentioned the corporate name, but when many fast food chains were putting in those order your own kiosks.
Yes.
And it said, welcome to your new minimum wage, which is a harsh comment, but it does highlight the trade-off that Jeremy's talking about. Additionally, we're near a full employment economy as an economy as a whole. Now, that's different than saying every region is enjoying that. But it does raise the issue that in order to get people to do something that used to be done in Canada, many times you'll have to draw them away from other jobs, which further increases wage rates. So the other thing I really like about Jeremy's letter is it starts to question, well, what are the knock-on effects of all these things? And Nick was doing that as well when she talked about when she started talking about retaliation from others and political campaigns or political lobbying, which then becomes a very inefficient exercise in a country because what you see, for instance, last time around with Trump tariffs, the retaliation was against the agricultural sector, and then Trump put, I think I remember the number, it was, well, the range, it was billions of dollars of subsidies in place for farmers because they were being hurt in the short run by these tariffs. Now, Trump has said recently, well, you better just get ready to sell the agricultural sector in the United States. You get ready to sell lots of food in the U.S. But I doubt many people are going to rip out soybean fields and successfully put in avocado trees in the Midwest. And again, that highlights the sort of inefficiencies that once you start...
The climate hasn't changed that much.
Yeah, once you start an imbroglio like this. Now, the one thing I will say is, in terms of retaliatory tariffs, we are boxing against T-Rex. I mean, we are such a huge net importer that when people threaten us to tariff our exports, it actually is a punch that can't land as effectively. You saw that very quickly when you saw what Trump did with Colombia, because there are plenty of substitutes for Colombian coffee, and the Colombian president figured that out really quickly and decided, yeah, you can send those plane loads of folks that are allegedly in your country illegally back to us. So again, I think just to highlight, taking a step back from sort of the hyperventilation that the press does because it's easy, and thinking about all the knock-on effects is the right way to think about what's happening here.
Do we think that these CEOs or other CEOs will have the power or the exercise or the influence to make some of these tariffs go away wholesale?
Yeah, clearly some of them will and some of them won't. And the inefficient thing becomes now departments will have – now corporations will place a lot of focus on lobbying the government because that in some cases is going to be a more productive activity than making sure your factory runs smoothly in terms of – productive in terms of what it yields for shareholders. So once you start to open up this can of worms, they start to crawl everywhere, and we're already starting to see that by virtue of the very fact that the three heads of the automakers got on a phone call with Trump and got this reversed. This can't be the only case where the tariff is going to significantly increase costs and disadvantage the United States, but it is a case where because of their size and visibility, the corporations got to the White House first.
Yeah, I think because it's such a big hammer, it's really easy to kind of layer this overall increase in tariffs and then piecemeal make deals with individual leaders in specific manufacturing or development fields or arenas. So, like, if you take Apple, for example, that's been resistant to some of the administration's initiatives. Does this now give the administration more leverage to persuade Apple to shift its tone on those issues? And I think you'll see just everyone kind of either lining up or not lining up and taking the hit. But I think each of them will go in succession and knock on Trump's door and say, hey, okay, here's what we're willing to do to try to get out of the negative or the most damaging impact of these policies.
That was Nick Rangel on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, March 6th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, March 7th, Joe was out and Sarah LaDuke hosted. She was joined by Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy, Bill Hammond, CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, and Professor of Economics at Siena College, Aaron Pasitti.
With the jobs report, I have a summary here from the Washington Post. The labor market picked up 151,000 jobs in February, a solid pace despite a massive layoff amongst federal workers that began to show up in the data. The employment rate ticked up to a 4.1%, extending low levels that have marked the past year. Federal government payrolls lost 10,000 jobs in February, and the jobs data was collected the second week of February when Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, was beginning to cut agency workforces. Also, in early February, some federal contracts and grants had been frozen or cut due to executive orders, which led to private sector layoffs among government contractors and nonprofits. This sentence from the New York Times. Economic forecasts have deteriorated in recent weeks, reflecting the upheaval from the federal layoffs, tariff moves, and immigration roundups. We do have, of course, in studio our economics professor, Aaron Pasitti, to teach us more about what the report says, what it means, and what is going to happen. Aaron.
Yeah, that's the big question, is what is going to happen, because this report was the first full month's report of the Trump presidency. So it really, and the survey itself is done in the second week of the month. So it really doesn't capture any of the effects of the DOGE layoffs. I know there was a decrease of 10,000 federal employees, but I think this is just kind of the, you know, the first report, which shows a very stable and continuously strong job market. The unemployment rate's been hovering at or below 4%. For a couple years, which is the lowest it's been on a consistent basis since the late 1960s. The economy's still adding enough jobs per month to keep the unemployment rate low. The other bright side of this report was that wage growth continues to be strong. Average hourly earnings increased 4% in the month of February, which is a full percentage point higher than the 3% inflation rate. So workers have been continuing for the past year and a half to experience wage gains that have exceeded the increase in the cost of living. So it's another strong report. It's not, it's not something that people are going to be cheering about. But as you said earlier, the question is, what's going to happen? And it looks like, based on how Trump is approaching a lot of economic policy, that he's trying to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, in that he's inherited a remarkably strong labor market that has been creating, you know, millions of jobs over the past couple years. Unemployment remains low, wage growth remains high, but yet a lot of the policies that he's been talking about have the potential, and I want to stress the word potential, because there's an enormous amount of uncertainty about whether he does impose permanent tariffs on Canada and Mexico, whether he increases them on China. There's an enormous amount of uncertainty regarding a lot of his economic policy, particularly as it relates to the tariffs, because it's, you know, tariffs are taxes on imported goods, which has the potential to raise prices for consumers. And it also has the potential to raise prices for businesses who rely on imported raw materials like steel and energy from Canada, for example.
Lumber.
Agricultural products from both China and Mexico. So the risk here is that, and it's not a risk that U.S. economists have been considering really since the 1970s, and that is the dreaded stagflation. Stagflation is the simultaneous occurrence of economic stagnation, meaning rising unemployment, but also rising inflation. And that's a very toxic combination that can be very difficult for policy, even competent policymakers, to address. So the tariffs and the potential for a trade war where Canada, Mexico, China, and, you know, members of the EU impose retaliatory tariffs on U.S. products. The tariffs on imported goods can raise prices for consumers, and then the retaliatory tariffs from our trading partners will increase the cost of raw materials for businesses. and that can reduce profit margins and lead to rising layoffs. So it's a term that economists don't use lightly, stagflation, but it's certainly something that appears to be in the cards. And the other thing that I want to stress is that in addition to the uncertainty and the likelihood that it could create inflation and rising unemployment, is that that has the potential to happen whether or not the tariffs actually are put in place.
Right, the uncertainty.
It's the uncertainty. Yeah. It's business, and I'm curious to hear Heather's viewpoint on this, because if the tariffs are on, and then at the last minute they're called off, and then on April 2nd the tariffs are back on, and then on April 3rd they're back off. Just that uncertainty, whether they're in place or not in place. Talking about the, you know, the Mar-a-Lago Accord, where he's talking about introducing 100-year government bonds to replace short-term debt, which is the functional equivalent of the U.S. government defaulting on its bondholders. All of these things, whether it's the Doge layoffs, the tariffs, the Mar-a-Lago Accord, just having that out in the air and knowing that we have a president who largely acts on whim and announces policy via social media at 3 a.m, that uncertainty, whether they happen or not, has the potential to freeze business investment. So I'm curious to hear what Heather has to say.
Well,
about
I wanted
some of
to ask
issues.
You a couple questions first, because
it's going to be a lot of questions for Aaron today.
I looked at this, and you know, this is the jobs report that is reflective of essentially the last month,
right?
Which none of which captures.
Yeah, right.
In the last month is all Trump administration, but it doesn't reflect any of the layoffs, right?
Nope.
It doesn't reflect any of the governmental layoffs. They're not – none of those occurred during this time frame. And the jobs report is usually – it's non-agriculture if I'm
– Yeah, private non-farm.
Private non-farm, right. So does that include government jobs?
So the Bureau of Labor Statistics has a variety of measures. There's all employees, which is federal government, private sector workers, and agriculture.
Yeah, because it gets confusing, because sometimes they don't include government and sometimes they do.
So the official release is non-farm.
Okay.
So it excludes agriculture is only 1% of total employment.
Right.
Right. So
So it doesn't matter.
It really doesn't have a big impact. Even if all many agricultural workers lost their job, you wouldn't see much movement in unemployment rates.
But they matter because there's food.
Well, exactly. I'm not saying they're not important.
Like,
but from a measurement
issue. You
wouldn't
see movement in unemployment, but you would see movement in our obesity rate.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and food insecurity.
Nobody eats food anymore anyway, so there's that.
the official releases that the Bureau of Labor Statistics produces does include federal government workers. And the total federal government workforce is not a huge share of total employment.
Right.
So even if we got rid of all of them, it would have a modest impact on the unemployment rate. But the risk isn't – there's the direct effect of 10,000 federal workers were off payrolls in February.
Right.
That's likely to increase depending on how aggressively they want to wield their comical chainsaw. But –
Well, I'm hearing now it's more of a scalpel. It's very surgical.
Oh, yeah, no, I've got thoughts on that, too.
It just isn't. No. Not right now.
There's multiplier and ripple effects.
Yeah.
You get rid of federal employees, then there's the downstream effects of, well, if they lose their job, then the jobs that are supported by their spending in their community start disappearing.
Well, and I agree with that, but I think there's other more important aspects of it, like what happens when permitting slows down? What happens, actually do things.
Yes.
There's,
they're not – when you lay off the person, you don't necessarily repeal the regulation that they were enforcing.
Right.
You still need
somebody
to
process. And by the way, I would
say
that having an analysis of – and using AI to have an analysis of regulatory overlap and all of that, that is a good thing. But starting with getting rid of the people is maybe not the most logical approach to it. I am concerned about sort of the psychological impact of people who are – federal employees who have now been cast into this sort of bucket of you're useless, right?
Who's going to, like, you know, people coming out of college,
right.
Are they going to want to?
Who's going to want to take the Foreign Service exam? And
which I didn't even know was a thing when I was in college. I think I would have taken it, you know, because that there's some cool jobs that you can get.
Oh, yeah.
But no,
there
so to your question, Professor, the tariffs thing, I mean, I've been asked a lot about it. And I'll start off by saying the first round, you know, the first time they were going to kick in, I was a little bit surprised at sort of where the questions were, because the media questions were very focused on food. And I thought, wow, yeah, this right. is, it's so not about food. I get it. Like, people are worried about food prices
avocados,
and everything.
That's my
and
personal.
Avocados, and yeah. I pointed out, you know, that we do grow avocados in the U.S. They're not the good ones. They're the big ones, which I don't even like. But the real impact is, I mean, Canada is New York's largest trading partner. And it's to the tune of billions, mm-hmm. billions of dollars and hundreds of thousands of jobs. U.S. is dependent on trade with Canada, just Canada. The Business Council was very active in negotiating the USMCA, which is the trade agreement with Canada and Mexico. Canada, again, being New York's largest trading partner. And we were very active in trying to get members of the New York congressional delegation to support USMCA, which was during Trump's first term as president. And it was, you know, very hard fought, and some very, I think, very good members of the House, Democrats, crossed the aisle to support USMCA and promptly lost their seats, which was unfortunate because it was they at the time, you know, this partisan world, they, in air quotes, betrayed their party by signing on to a trade deal with Mexico and Canada that the party did not want to give the Trump administration a victory on. But it was a good deal. And now the tariffs would seem to kind of fly in the face of even having a deal. I get that it's a negotiating tactic, and I think most of the business community understands that. And I talk all the time.
What is he negotiating
well,
for?
Well, there are some problems. There are some problems with the USMCA, and it is up for review, I believe, next year. There's a periodic review of trade agreements.
Has he even brought that up?
It's not. That has not been discussed publicly. Yeah. The problems really mostly relate to Mexico, fentanyl being one of them. And yesterday, the New York Times, they have a daily podcast called The Daily.
Original.
Interesting name.
Heard of it?
Yesterday's Daily actually was an analysis of whether or not the threats have been effective. And the answer to that is yes. Mm-hmm. Fentanyl trafficking through the Mexican border has essentially stopped, all because of efforts that the threat of this of the tariffs has caused the Mexican president to effectively shut down all the trafficking via Mexico of fentanyl. The reporter is embedded. There's a reporter, a Times reporter, and, you know, the Times is no friend to President Trump. So I do not believe that this was a fluff piece where they were trying to prop him up.
No, they had didn't. Was that the article where they were quoting like drug traffickers who were like afraid for their lives?
Yeah, it was the extradition of the top level cartel members to the U.S. is just like, oh.
We are discussing the jobs report, the tariffs starting and stopping willy-nilly all over America and the world, and other business issues. Panel, begin again.
Okay, so all I was saying was that the to the extent that the tariffs, the threat of the tariffs, were motivated in part to stop fentanyl trafficking from coming through the southern border from Mexico, which is one of the gripes about USMCA, that is one of the things that the president wants to correct. Not that that was part of the trade deal, but one of the things that he wants to leverage. It has been effective, right? It has stopped. Now, is it going to remain effective? Who knows? But for
also
now,
due to the efforts of the Mexican president, who
right,
deserves credit
right,
too,
right.
I think.
But she could have done this already. Right. I mean,
well,
I guess that's
the argument.
It's kind
of surprising. I mean, I thought the problem in Mexico was that the cartels were so embedded and so powerful that the government could not.
Well,
like
and,
they
right,
would,
that
they
was,
would
that was the
risk
narrative,
their
right?
lives if
that
they
was that
didn't
was
even.
The narrative. And yet, I mean, here I again, I don't think the New York Times were doing some
right.
kind of favor to
mm-hmm.
the president. I think Canada, I think there's a personality thing here, right? Like, Trump really doesn't like Trudeau. And so they may be sort of the included in the tariff because they're a border state, like Mexico is a border state. So they get, you know, lumped in the, you know, again, air quotes, fentanyl problem, even though there's really not much fentanyl, I think, coming through the northern border.
Nope.
But I think that it was recognized by a lot of people that this is essentially a negotiating tactic. Negotiating for what? Who knows? Maybe negotiating for Trudeau to kiss the ring or something. But I can't tell you how many calls from business organizations north of the border, you know, who are really concerned, as we are. Of great concern is the surcharge on energy and the potential of reciprocal tariffs coming from Canada, because New York sources a lot of energy from Canada. Our clean energy goals are very dependent on Canadian hydro and electricity that is generated from Canadian hydro. New York has a lot of our clean energy goals are very dependent on power that is generated in Canada. And, you know, if there is a surcharge, we are already an extremely high cost energy state. This is going to exacerbate that should the tariffs kick in. And Canada can do this if they want to right now.
Yeah.
They don't need to wait. Right. You know, so it's you know, as far as diplomacy goes, it's really not.
This is how trade
helpful.
Wars work.
Yes.
Is that,
yes.
You know, somebody makes a move and then somebody makes a counter move. But yeah, no, on the Ontario Premier's pledge to impose a 25% surcharge on electricity, it's New York, Michigan, and Minnesota. So there's obviously so that's inflationary and contractionary because it will increase the cost of doing business for companies that rely on that. But it also affects the overall stability and reliability of energy grids in terms of, you know, if we have another polar vortex at the end of March and all of a sudden, you know, electricity usage surges, you know, that happened in Texas. And what you have are these, you know, blowups in consumers' electricity bills.
Well,
means they need to reallocate spending from, I don't know, tourism and entertainment to paying their heating bill. And that has the again, we're back to stagflation. It depresses growth because it reallocates spending away from consumer goods. And then so that depresses economic activity while at the same time raising prices.
We're also like flying pretty close to the edge with respect to having enough energy, having enough electricity to keep our grid running.
That was Bill Hammond on the Roundtable panel on Friday, March 7th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.